Welcome to the Jackalcast.
Hello, this is Steven.
And this is Steven.
Excellent. Well, what a strange year that this has been so far. I mean, no month of March whatsoever. I flipped my calendar, went straight from February into April.
Absolutely. Yes, that's what I'm going to claim from here on out.
I believe that it was by governmental decree. Which government? I'll leave to your imagination.
I believe in order to balance the calendar properly, we had to add a February 29th and then skip March entirely.
And so it is only fitting that we interviewed someone that someday wants to be able to add his own name to the calendar. I believe that, you know, Siglericus, the month, will come sometime between March and February. Anyway, yes, so today we are featuring an interview with Mr. Scott Sigler. Now, I can hear you asking, who is Scott Sigler?
Blasphemy.
But just in case you don't know, Scott Sigler is a New York Times bestselling author and an award-winning podcaster. His novel Earthcore was the first original podcast-only novel way back in 2005. Since then, he has continued to release his novels as free podcasts. He writes in a blend of science fiction horror with an emphasis on biology, but he's also broken new ground. I think he is the only person that I have ever heard of that has reinvigorated the genre of science fiction sports, a genre previously occupied only by brittle innings about Frankenstein's monster playing baseball, and the children's novel Freddy and the Baseball Team from Mars, which I just pulled right now from the recesses of my childhood.
The internet is a wonderful thing.
Yes, but the scary thing is I didn't look that one up. But one of the nice things about Scott is that he's upfront about his goals. And, you know, we all have our goals in life. You know, I want to lose some weight and become fitter. Scott wants to become an evil dictator, or future dark overlord, as he puts it. And as a goal, I think it's a pretty achievable one. His latest novel, Nocturnal, is already available for pre-order at scottsigler.com and will be released very, very shortly, so you should all go and have a look. And he will also be a featured guest at the upcoming science fiction convention, Convolution, happening November 2nd through 4th at which hotel?
That would be the Hyatt SFO in Burlingame, California.
Right. I don't know why we happen to know that off the tops of our heads, but we just happen to. So is there anything else we should say about Scott Sigler before we roll into our interview?
I'm not sure there's anything else to say about Scott Sigler. I think Scott will pretty much say it all.
Excellent.
Other than I was really jealous that you got to interview him and I was unable to. I was on an airplane.
Yes. Well, don't worry. Once he takes over as the future Dark Overlord, then we will all be forced to interview Scott Sigler every hour of every day. Okay, Scott Sigler, welcome to the Jackalcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So you've got a book coming out. I hear rumors.
Yes. Yeah. You hear rumors and you hear me screaming from the rooftops of the internet as well. The book is called Nocturnal. It is out April 3rd. It is a horror thriller that I describe as Lethal Weapon meets Hellboy. So it's kind of fun.
So, I mean, I've heard a previous version of this. Is this a newly reimagined thing or...
Well, the version that was out before was a free podcast I had out, and I was writing a chapter and recording and podcasting a chapter a week.
Right.
And so that was first draft, and it turned out pretty well for first draft, but it still was a first draft. And since my books are very plot heavy and they're suspense driven, I wasn't able to go back and change anything. So if I wanted to change something in chapter one, once I got to chapter nine, to provide better continuity or better flow, I couldn't do that because it was already out. So. Right. People have heard the first draft and liked it, but this is about six or seven drafts later. It's finished and pretty polished, so it's very different. And it's got a completely different ending to it as well.
I would say that Nocturnal has elements of a police procedural, sort of with a science fiction edge to it, and also sort of a secret history of San Francisco. Is this your first San Francisco novel?
This is my first one in San Francisco. The other ones have been set in Michigan, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. So I've been in San Francisco for a few years now, so this is my first one set in the city by the bay. And it does start out as a police procedural. We're following Brian Clauser and Pookie Chang, who are homicide inspectors in San Francisco, and they're mm-hmm. tracking down some really gruesome serial killings. And then we learn there is something bigger afoot, and there is a secret society in San Francisco that has been here since before the gold rush. And being able to study up on some of the history of the city and learn about, for example, all the hidden tunnels that pervade through San Francisco and the buried ships of San Francisco were things that were particularly cool to be able to bring those to bear in the story.
I think I may have been nearby when you discovered it. You were down at BayCon. We had just done a podcasting panel. You and my brother and some other people and myself went to the bar, and you were talking about you had just discovered that there were these ships under San Francisco, and you were really excited about it.
Yeah, they're all these ships that came from the gold rush. And I don't think, unless you've learned a little bit about that history, I don't think people understand what gold rush really means. It means people came from all over the world. They packed into boats, and it was there was so much excitement to go out and find this gold that, of course, it was easy to get, right? To go find this gold, that even the crews and captains of the ships would pull into San Francisco Bay, get off the ship, and just abandon the ship forever, and then go out to make their fortune. And as the city grew, the bay wound up being packed with all these derelict vessels, and a lot of them sunk, and eventually the city just literally filled in the bay with landfill. And you can take the Barbary Coast Tour in San Francisco, which is this bit of metal that's embedded in the sidewalk, and you can literally walk along where the old water line is. But most of downtown San Francisco was originally part of San Francisco Bay. It's been filled in, and to this day, when people dig there for building foundations, more times than not, they hit a ship, and they have to stop and bring an archaeologist to kind of document it and see what they can see. It's very very interesting history to the city.
But there's a lot of biology also in this book as well. Did you have to do a lot of research on the biology in it?
I did quite a bit of research into biology. I'm kind of a layman biologist. I read the popular culture stuff like New Scientist and Discover and watch the TV shows and can kind of put that knowledge together to outline a rough plot. Like, how are we going to make a suspense thriller that's horrifying and yet it has a hard science, hard biology backdrop to it? And then I will outline that and turn that over to my three amigos of doom, which are two PhDs and an MD that go through it really carefully and try and find out what is accurate, what is inaccurate, and what other brand new research can they bring to bear to make it cutting edge, make it exciting. So I'm trying to write a horror story. I'm just not using ghosts and goblins and vampires and the supernatural of any kind.
Can you tell us a little bit about the main characters?
The main characters are Brian Clauser, and he has been a San Francisco homicide detective for about 7 or 8 years. He's the serious, moody type. He's already killed 4 guys in the line of duty, and they were all clean shoots, and they all came to save the life of another cop. So a lot of what he's been through has been right place at the wrong time and then just taking care of business.
Right.
Highly respected in the department. His nickname in the department is the Terminator because he's killed people and he just has very little emotional response to anything. He's kind of an automaton just going about his day. His partner is kind of the polar opposite of that, and that is Lawrence Pookie Chang. And Pookie is gregarious and outgoing and remembers little details about everyone he meets. Everybody is Pookie's friend, and Pookie is friend to everybody. So it's Pookie and Brian together create kind of a nice dynamic. They're close buddies, and they really count on each other a lot. The other dynamic that's fun about them is Pookie is a Christian. He's not proselytizing or out thumping the Bible, but he's confident in his beliefs. He knows what he believes, while Brian is a skeptic and believes in none of it. So there's some conversations between the two, and then that gets interesting when they get further into the story and start to see stuff that is just absolutely unbelievable, and Brian is to blame for some of these things. It's oddly Pookie being skeptical about what he sees that lets them push through the plot together.
Awesome.
Really, it's all of the cool stuff in San Francisco, all the hidden tunnels and some of the history of Chinatown and what went on there in the first wave of immigrants. There's so much going on in this book. Right. Ton of biology. It does turn into a modern day monster story. So I think people are going to dig it. And the one thing I'd like your listeners to keep in mind is they might want to pick up the book because I've used the phrase the mother of all monsters. And it's it really is an accurate description of the book, because there is a character in this called Mommy, and when people finally see Mommy, they're going to be a little bit skeeved out.
Yeah, it's quite literal. I mean, I got a pretty strong stomach, and just the audio descriptions, and I'm sure you've improved them six times by now.
I hope so, yeah. Hopefully they're very accurate, but I'm really proud of the structure and the culture that I've created. And Mommy, I think, you know, if we were ever to be fortunate enough to have a movie made of this, mm-hmm. it's really could be really one of those iconic elements of horror cinema. So I hope that happens.
I remember that there was a map when you originally did the podcast where you actually mapped out all of the locations so you could actually go and visit, you know, close approximations of where all of this would be. I forget, was that something you did or was this a fan-produced thing?
No, I did that. I did a Google map. It was one of the fun things you can do, as it was a serialized story taking place over the better part of a year, I think.
Right.
I was able to go visit a location in San Francisco and then add it to the Nocturnal Google map. And then several people who have vacationed here and happen to be fans have gone on the Nocturnal tour where they get to go from site to site. It's a little gruesome when you think about it, but hey, whatever. They go from site to site, and they get to see the exact settings where the story took place, and it wound up being really cool. I actually did use the same, a new Google map to write Nocturnal, just to make sure. I'm like, okay, it takes about 10 minutes to get from here to here. What are they going to see on the street when they go here, etc.? I don't know whether I'll share that or not, because the map itself is inherently has a couple of spoilers, I think.
Right.
But it... Google Maps for using a real location continues to be a great, great device for writers.
You are a New York Times best-selling writer. How did that change your life?
It really didn't change all that much. I already had a 5-book deal with Crown Random House when the first book did not hit the list, second book did hit the list. And it was largely just the validation of a lifelong goal. That's something I've wanted since I've been in grade school. So to be able to finally get that and then to see the next book with New York Times bestseller on the cover is quite a momentous thing. But, you know, it wasn't like a top 10. And that's the range you have to get in really for your life to change. If you get up into the top 10, then all the bookstores suddenly buy the book and stock the book. More bookstore workers read it. And so they can hand sell it to people in the store. It gets the attention of Amazon buyers, etc. So hopefully we'll make that happen with Nocturnal, but it remains to be seen.
Now, you're a little bit unlike a lot of what writers used to be in that you take a lot of the marketing into your own hands, or at least you're certainly willing to. Have all publishers really understood? Have they been a little bit surprised when you come bursting in the door saying, hey, what are we going to do about this?
I think that they have, and you know that's created some conflict here and there, but by and large, the group I'm working at now with Crown is really happy with it. They have an author who is invested in the success of the book, who is not just handing them the book and saying, okay, go make me a bestseller. Here you go. I mean, I'm doing a number of things to try and promote pre-orders for Nocturnal and drive the sales, the first week sales figures up, because all pre-orders roll into that first week of sales.
Right.
So they're happy with it. I would rather the publisher be doing that part, but the publisher can't promote every book with all the money that they've got.
Right.
It creates a bit of a strange backlash in that mm-hmm. the publisher, a lot of times the publisher, instead of saying, wow, look at the head start this author has given us, let's go pour some money into marketing and capitalize on that. Right. Instead, the general reaction is, wow, the author is doing a lot of our job for us. Let's spend this money somewhere else with someone who needs the help.
Right.
So it's kind of, from a business sense, the publishing at all levels is a very strange business that doesn't make a lot of sense to people outside of publishing. That part doesn't make sense to me, and I wish that would change, but you gotta go with what you've got.
You're publishing some of your novels sort of more mainstream with Crown, and then you're self-publishing the GFL series. The GFL is the Galactic Football League. How have those experiences been different?
Well, the difference is when you're writing for Crown, you have an editor there who is trying to form the book into something that's commercially viable. Mm-hmm. You've got people in charge of making covers and people in charge of book design. And for the most part, the author is supposed to stay out of those things. Publishing is a business of specialization, and they expect the author to write the book and write the best book they can, then they do all the other elements. Mm-hmm. I'm much more hands-on and can be a bit abrasive at times, because I know how it I know my audience. I know the people are going to buy this book, and I want the book to look and feel a certain way. I want it to be marketed a certain way so that it hits that group of fans. So it's different with Crown in that they're in charge of a lot of areas of the book, and I have to help guide things as much as I can without ruffling any feathers or getting in their way, because they're also good at their jobs. Right. The difference is over in Dark Overlord Media, and that's the company Kovacs and I have that put out the Galactic Football League books, it's the Wild West. We can do anything that we want to do. Hold on. Sirens are coming.
They're coming for you. They found you.
Here they go. So it's on the one hand, with Crown, you've got a support structure and you can count on people to go do some of the more esoteric elements. And on the other hand, A and I have to do everything ourselves and contract people to do covers and interior design, etc. But we can do anything we want to do. Want to put a 16-page color insert in there? Done. Want to do embossing on the cover? We can do that. Want to write over 120,000-word book? It's a completely different experience. It's a lot more fun, I think, to do our own books and do the Galactic Football League books.
You just come up with a great product. I mean, I buy five of them a time and just give them away as gifts and so forth. And they say, well, if you give the book away, then why would somebody buy it? Well, there's the answer. You've got this amazing artifact that it really enhances the experience.
And we give the book away. We give all the books away as free podcasts, and then we sell them as ebooks, audiobooks, and print books. And yeah, the giving stuff away creates this sense of gratefulness with the audience. Because I say this on every interview. Piracy isn't a problem. The problem is people spending their money on something that turns out to suck. And then you can't get your money back and you're angry and you're bitter. So if you're willing to actually step up ahead of time and say, hey, I will give this away to you to prove how good it is, then later on if you want to buy it or continue buying my books, you can do that. I do not live in a war zone, by the way. I don't.
I was thinking I could somehow wrap into the intro that somehow, you know, all of the forces of evil or good were converging on you. But
it's a little busy. It's a little busy in San Francisco today. So, you know, the giving it away creates that sense of endearment. But really the biggest difference is Crown Publishing primarily makes their money with nonfiction titles. And they are fantastic at packaging those books, like they've done Barack Obama's book and Pete Sampras's book, to name a few. But they don't really get the genre sci-fi horror audience yet.
Right.
And when A and I are both crazy sci-fi geeks. So when we put a book together, we're like, we could do this. And her reaction would be, oh my God, people will love that, because she's the same kind of person who would buy the book. So with the football books, the Galactic Football League series, which we describe as Star Wars meets Any Given Sunday meets The Godfather, we can do whatever we want, craft it for guys like you. And on Crown, you got to kind of, it's book by committee.
I'm sure you've heard this 1,000 times, but I think that this is a major breakthrough, because I'll tell you, I started watching at least the Super Bowl and started getting more into football after reading the GFL series, because now I understand what's going on. I can really identify it. It's a little harder to understand when all of the players are the same species, but, you know, every game has its limitations.
I get that so much, and I'm sure there are people listening to this who are like, oh, football, I hate football. That's usually the reaction that people have. Now, with my podcast, I have got an existing audience. I've been able to say, just give it 4 episodes. Just give it a try.
And I will tell you, that was my reaction. It's just like, okay, you know, I'll go with Scott on this one, but he's gone off the deep end. This is nuts. And I'll tell you, I love the GFL series.
It's really, it's a giant space opera. It's trying to establish its world and universe building, attempting it like on the scale of an Asimov. It's a really big universe that we're creating. And you've got a classic coming of age story in the main quarterback, Quentin Barnes, who comes from a racist, all-human system, but wants to play in the big leagues. So he has to join a league where the different positions are played by aliens. And these are aliens that his religion has taught him to hate and kill and never trust. So it's a big adjustment for him. And it's largely a parable of my growing up in an all-white bred community and then joining the bigger world when I go to college and get into professional space. So it's really giant space opera, coming-of-age story, a lot of commentary on racism and the ability of sports to overcome racism, a lot of political commentary. Football is largely just, it's the backdrop. And largely, instead of instead of him being in the Navy or him being in the Merchant Marines, for example, or him being a traitor, he's a football player. It's the backdrop of the whole thing. But what that gives you is all of the color and pageantry of football and all of the team identification and some of the really cool things about the sport. And if people read it, I've found ways to actually tell them what's going on in a football field without making it a lecture.
Right. No, that's the beauty of it for me. It's just like there are at least very few segments where you explain what a tight end is or anything like that. But you get it. It's sort of part of the narrative and you figure out why it's so important that this player plays this position and so forth.
Well, it's one of the nerd, you know, being a nerd that I happen to be nerd slash jock.
Right.
And so I grew up in a soul culture. My dad was, my dad was taking me to see the King Kong movies and Star Wars movies. And then he was also the head football coach. But a lot of nerds and geeks, you get this automatic knee-jerk response that is a sport for dumb jocks. It's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. And they're absolutely right about the last part. It doesn't make any sense because there's like 27 little tiny easy things you have to learn before you can even start to follow what's going on the football field. So by using this science fiction story to show kids and show sci-fi fans, like, here's all the little things. It's not, you know, you just got to be patient, pick up all these things. Then all of a sudden what you're seeing on the screen isn't so confusing. Mm-hmm. And when you watch a game and you start to understand what's going on, then you get roped into the stories of all the players. And that's where all of the TV broadcasts are so good. Football is a primetime drama. You're following all these players, following their career, following how they do in a season. And once you get the rules out of the way, it becomes really, really fun. My favorite part about The Rookie, though, is when the geeks like us, so to speak, get to the part where I go through the math that a pro quarterback has to process on every play.
Yeah.
And people are just blown away. Because people, if you don't know the game, you do think it's a game for dumb jocks. When you understand the computational tree a quarterback has to go through in 3 seconds every play, when people are literally trying to kill him, it's pretty impressive. You get a lot of respect for the players.
That went into your previous series, Infected, where your main character, who is this incredibly huge football player, and he surprises someone with his intelligence. And they say, well, God, I thought you were a dumb jock. Just like, well, no, some sports have dumb jocks. Don't get it wrong. But not football, because in football you have to be smart.
Yeah, that's kind of the general approach. And there's prejudice in amongst our culture. If you see a great big guy's football player, your initial reaction is, well, he's a big dummy, which is sad and upsetting because so many of us had trouble in junior high and high school of being judged for the way we looked, the way we acted, the books we read, D&D, all of that stuff. And our segment of the populace has a tendency to turn around and do exactly the same thing to some other group. So largely you see a great big guy, but as you learn more about professional sports, and I don't know much about basketball and other sports, but I do know a lot about football, the amount of study that these guys have to have, the amount of knowledge they have to have on everybody they face, on the playbook, there is just an astronomical amount of learning that has to be done before you even get to the part where they're big and strong and fast and athletically talented. So it's a really cool book for that. It's kind of an eye-opener for some people. And if it helps people enjoy the sport, it's great. I mean, some of the most satisfying things I've ever heard in my career is getting emails from people who say, you know, I went home for Thanksgiving and I was able to sit on the couch and watch the football game with my dad and understand what's going on. And we have never done that before. And it's really cool. Thanks for explaining it in a sci-fi context that I could understand and want to learn more. So, I bring families together. That's what I do.
Well, you know, sometimes at science fiction conventions, I'll put on my Galactic Football League jersey. The valets and so forth will suddenly sort of break out of role and say, who are the Krakens? What league do they play for? And I will say, well, the Galactic Football League. And I'll get such blank stares. And one more GFL question. I was just listening to an episode today that featured one of your more recent characters, George Starcher. I was sort of curious as to where he came from, and does he possibly carry a towel in deference to Douglas Adams?
I've tried to populate the team with a lot of over-the-top characters. Quentin Barnes, the main character, is really kind of an everyman who's thrown into a crazy situation that's diametrically opposed to everything he's been taught growing up. So he's kind of the straight man of the book. Then everybody, all the other characters, you try and draw from some of the wild personalities you get in sports. And George Starcher, a tight end, has got some mental issues and spends a lot of time talking to his towel. He paints his face before every game a different color. He talks to his towel like it's a person. So it didn't really come from anywhere, but it does play a little bit on the superstition of football players. You know, and there are, like my dad, for example, when I played high school football for my dad, he had to wear the exact same outfit every Friday.
Wow.
He had, I mean, and he kept it from season to season. It could never change. Every Friday after school, before getting for the game, he would go to McDonald's, get two Filet-O-Fish and a large fries, because he'd had that once and he won. He would do all that, and he had all of these rituals that I used to think were silly, and now I think I understand it a little better. You know, rituals are just a way of getting your brain into a certain state of mind, getting you prepared to do something. But he had all of these rituals that made absolutely no sense, so that's kind of where George Starcher comes from. George does what George has to do before the game. Hopefully then he can go out and play the game.
Do you have any rituals yourself, at least that you can tell us about?
I don't have any rituals outside of I don't do sports anymore. Back when I used to play them, there was a lot of listening to particular kinds of music before events, and there was tying my wrestling shoes in a particular way in a particular pattern. The one ritual I had that thankfully didn't kill me was, as a junior in high school, I became convinced that the more caffeine I had, the better I would wrestle. So
Has this stopped? It has stopped.
The big thing back then was called the One for the Road bar, and it was a candy bar with the equivalent of two cups of coffee. So my buddies and I would get a case of One for the Road bars and a case of Mountain Dew, and like we would ride the bus at 5 o'clock in the morning to go to some wrestling tournament. And I would eat like four of these things and drink a couple of Mountain Dews, and it would get to the point where I was so, and I was hyper to start with. I was so hyper, I would just be pacing the mat, like, you know, all the matches before me, just flinging my hands into the air and just trying to burn off some of this energy. And I didn't know I was doing it.
I can't even imagine.
It was nuts. It was nuts. And it wasn't until I was watching film one day of one of our tournaments, and we're watching the match of the kid who wrestled before me, and then in the background, there's me walking really fast up and down the side of the mat, waving my hands around like a madman, and I had no recollection of ever having done that at all. And I was like, whoa, whoa.
Who's that guy?
I gotta back off. This caffeine theory is not working out for me. That ritual went away.
It probably had a psychological effect on the other team.
I think
just like that guy's crazy.
Oh, it did. I mean, one of my high points in wrestling was I had five matches my senior year where they just didn't put a kid on the mat. They had a kid who could wrestle the weight, and they're like, "Yeah, which not? No, he's not gonna wrestle."
Yeah, we're done.
we're done here. And it was
we're afraid that the other guy might think he's a candy bar.
Oh, it was a really good time, but that was an awful lot of caffeine for somebody who weighed 126 pounds.
Yeah, seriously. Okay. So your fans, of course, you know, as you're saying, you know, there's appeal to both, shall we say, nerds and jocks in your fiction. So I would imagine that your fan base is a little bit more diverse than your average science fiction writer. Of course, you know, never having been another science fiction writer, maybe it's hard for you to say, but do you think that the Junkies, which is the name that you gave your fans after people were pleading for your fiction as though it were some kind of drug hit, do you think Junkies are different from your average fan? And I say, ask this as an original Junkie myself.
I don't really think so. It's not so different from Joss Whedon fans. I think people gravitate towards a certain literary tone that reflects some of their inner personality. So in that regard, my fans, are a little bit different than others, but crazy fandom is such a big part of sci-fi, and so many people find some kind of storyline or world to latch onto and kind of make their own. And it's been different for me because of the podcast, and you can't contact Joss Whedon. You can't email Joss and get on Joss's blog and have him reply to you. And for the past 5 years, You know, I reply to Twitters, I reply to emails, reply to everybody's Facebook posts. People are calling in my Gore line for the podcast, hearing their own voice on my podcast, hearing me respond to it. And therefore, the fan base has kind of shaped itself as the really, really down-to-earth people. And this is kind of their one crazy thing, is following everything that I do. So I don't know how much different they are than other sci-fi authors, but I sure like them.
So you grew up in Sheboygan. Can you just say Sheboygan for me?
Sheboygan.
Sheboygan.
I grew up in Sheboygan.
Mm-hmm. Come from Sheboygan. So, and that seems to be like exactly in the middle finger spot of the Michigan glove?
Yeah, it is exactly. We are the middle finger of Michigan. It's right up at the tip, right before you cross over the bridge over into the Upper Peninsula. And that's where I grew up and was there until I was a sophomore in college.
Right. And you did wrestling and high school football. Did you have any choice about the high school football or basically?
No. I totally had a choice to the high school football because when I started playing football, I weighed like 92 pounds in my freshman year. And my mom was actually really concerned. My brother played. My older brother played, but he was much bigger and stronger and really good athlete. I was not. So I was busy playing D&D for 48 hours straight over the weekend. But when it came, they wouldn't let us play Little League football because, growth plates, and they felt it, you know, could damage your growth. So we never played. And then my freshman year came, and my mom and dad wanted to sit down and have a talk with me and asked if I wanted to play golf instead. And I could tell that this was a conversation that was just killing my dad. My dad was like, I'm going to do the right thing by the kid. I'll give him an opportunity if he wants to do this other thing. My dad was basically trying to present it like, well, I don't want him to think he has to go in this or I'll be disappointed in him. and then I'm like, no, I'm going to play football. I'm not going to play golf.
Right.
And then my mom said,
I'm just imagining you playing golf. Do you play golf?
I played for a little while, but it's just too expensive. It probably would have been an ideal sport for me to go into because I just I was small and slow. It was a bad combination. I was a little D&D geek. I should not have been in a football uniform. And my mom then said, we got serious considerations and we don't want you to get hurt. So we're considering not letting you play football. And that the only time I said this in my whole life, I looked at my mom and said, if you don't let me play football, I'm running away tomorrow.
And you meant it.
I meant it. And I remember my dad, he he's sitting down, he kind of slaps his thighs and stands up and goes, well, fuck it, Carol, we tried. He's playing football.
Well, let's see. I believe I've heard you interview both of your parents.
Yep, yep.
And they are truly awesome people, as I'm sure I don't have to tell you.
I'm a lucky guy. They're fantastic.
Well, let's see. I had a whole other question I was going to ask, but that last line of it kind of chased it out of my head there. D&D. In my copious research, I determined that I don't hear you talk about this ever, but your name is on at least some role-playing game material.
Yeah,
there's stuff about champions. So how did you get into writing that stuff, and what was the experience?
Well, I've been an aspiring writer forever.
Right.
And when we started playing D&D, I immediately gravitated towards the Dungeon Master role and then the Game Master for champions. And mm-hmm. I just really liked creating these intricate long-form plots and writing a story that was so good my friends would get hooked on it and watching their response when they played. When I would bust out a plot point or do a big reveal and seeing how they reacted. And then that developed a love for the long form storytelling and burying foreshadowing along the way. So I was a big fan of, okay, it's January. I'm going to start planting little seeds that you won't see literally until August or July of us playing every weekend. Mm-hmm. And then when you get there and you watch the reaction on their face when they realize that, you know, they've been seeing this plot building all along and all the answers were there and they just missed it, there was such a look of shock and awe and giddiness on their face that I was in love with doing that. It was the greatest thing I did with my buddies. So that naturally, and then there was a lot of immaturity and arrogance there as well to get into the writing. Cause I would read the supplements and the D&D modules and I'd be like, this plot sucks. This doesn't make any sense. And I got a bee in my bonnet that I was going to start writing adventures. And I wrote one article for White Wolf, an article called Seed Shire, which I thought was really fun. And then we started playing Champions, and being a comic book guy, I fell in love with Champions and then was able to write Champions for, I just started submitting proposals and met the guys at Gen Con, and they said, all right, let's write some modules together. So I was doing it in college, and it was an excellent development skill that taught me to be a better writer and a better plot creator.
Wow. Do you ever think you might go back, turn some of your fiction into role-playing games?
I don't think so, just from a business perspective.
Right.
I'd be happy to collaborate with somebody to make it into a video game. That'd be pretty cool. But I can't see going back, because role-playing games, there's two reasons. Number one, they're an enormous amount of work. Right. People who do those role-playing games, it's a ton of work to put those out. It's really a labor of love, because you're not going to make all that much money at it. And then the other thing is, I was really into role-playing games as a kid because there weren't video games. We did not have video games of the caliber we have now. You know, why you would want to sit around a tabletop and play D&D, which is still a great way to hang out with your friends, when you can just jump online and be playing World of Warcraft, that's a pretty tough sell. So from that business perspective, I can't imagine putting all that time to go into it when what the customers really want right now is more and better video games.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So you mentioned Gen Con in there. Have you done a lot of conventions? You've done some conventions out here in California. Were those your first science fiction conventions, or have you been going way back?
Goes way back. We did our first, gosh, we're all growing up now type outing was my buddies and I going to Gen Con in Milwaukee. And so we drove from Sheboygan all the way down to all the way to Milwaukee for that convention. And it was super exciting. It was kind of our first time away from home without adult supervision, although one of our buddies' dads lived in the area. But we drove to Gen Con, got hotel, went to the convention. It was pretty awesome. Then continued to go to Gen Con through college. And since then, kind of since getting it, since the writing has developed, then I've started to go to Comic-Con, Balticon, some DragonCon. DragonCon is really the other big one. So those are the ones I hit every year, and then try and grab whatever conventions are around that I can get into as well. I really like it. It's a great way to get in front of fans and meet fans, but by and large, it's a way to hang out with other writers, and you develop kind of a friend culture on the con circuit. There are certain people who are at every con. You see them every year, and they become really great friends, and it's a fantastic way to hang out.
So, yeah, I know you're coming to Convolution coming up.
Yep.
As the official podcast of Convolution, I am hereby obligated to plug it.
Great.
I hope you'll have a good time there. Are you looking forward to any ones coming up in particular?
Well, Convolution's going to be good. I'm not doing Baycon this year. You have to choose between Baycon and Balticon, and Balticon has really become a focal point for meeting my crew.
Yeah, it's Sigler Fest. Really,
so. We did Sigler Fest there last year. And I'm always looking forward to Dragon Con. It's fantastic. Not really looking forward to Comic Con that much. That's just too big and too crazy. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones. And Balticon's fun. Should be a good time.
Yes. So at Balticon, are any of your alter egos going to make an appearance?
I'm not sure. I haven't got word from Soupbone or General Siglerissimo or Pope Siglericus the 30th yet. But I will be sure to let people know as soon as that happens.
Yeah, I'm sure that they're very busy, and the internal communication system that you use for them is, kind of slow. So
yeah, a little slow.
You were a Toastmaster at Baycon a few years back, and one of the best Toastmasters, I think, in a while. I mean, you just, you're a wonderful announcer. You actually put these presentations together for the other guests. And, hey, if you're listening to me, and if you are considering booking a Toastmaster, and Scott is not incredibly busy at that time, call him.
Yeah, that was a really fun, it was a fun con and a fun toast. I had a good time.
I think that covers everything that we need to talk about. If we've gotten to this point in the interview and you haven't decided to go out and buy Scott's book, this is going to be our last chance to pitch it to you. So, Scott?
Well, everybody should go out and get a copy of Nocturnal. It's a gigantic 560-page book. It is modern-day police procedural. It is a horror novel. It is sci-fi. There's some good old monsters in it, and you will meet the mother of all monsters. It is it's got a lot of standard elements of sci-fi and horror, but you have not read anything like this. And if you are at all a biology buff, you will really get a kick out of seeing the culture that these monsters have developed. It's coming out April 3rd, and people can check it out at scottsigler.com/nocturnal.
Okay, awesome. Well, Scott, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Okay.